$10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For our Tom Hartman Book Club excerpt today, we're reading from Ed Morales' new book, Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. This is from the first chapter. There was never any doubt that the United States wanted Puerto Rico for its own when it began a war with Spain near the turn of the 20th century. Cuba had been in the throes of independence war with Spain off and on since 1868, and the conflict that began in 1895 seemed ripe for the United States to capitalize on. The sinking of the USS Maine, an American naval ship destroyed by an explosion while moored just outside Havana, fueled American entry into the war. Although there are conflicting theories about the source of the explosion, including the likelihood it was caused by a spontaneous internal fire, William Randolph Hearst's newspaper chain blew up the incident into the perfect catalyst for the United States to enter the conflict. When Theodore Roosevelt entered the fray with his army of Rough Riders, the whole affair came as no surprise to anyone who'd been paying attention to the lust U.S. government leaders and military had long expressed to expand southward and westward. And although the idea of manifest destiny was at the forefront of the political discourse of this period, it's less often observed that the United States' expansionist gaze was saturated with racial language and attitudes, at once desirous of and repelled by Latin America's mestizo mulatto social dynamic. The Haitian Revolution at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th created a U.S. obsession with both Cuba and Puerto Rico because of the potential of a similar black-led revolt on those islands. In 1826, Virginia Senator John Randolph feared that such a revolt would render the southern United States vulnerable to invasion from Cubans in rowboats. For this reason, he objected to the United States participating in the 1826 Panama Congress because American diplomats would have to endure the horror of a U.S. diplomat taking his seat in the Congress, quote, beside the native African, their American descendants, the mixed breeds, the Indians, and the half-breeds, without any offense or scandal at so motley a mixture, end quote. The logic driving this perspective underlined not only the importance of slavery to the emergence of capitalism in the 19th century, but also, as Matthew Karp points out in this vast southern empire, the extent to which slave owners and their elected representatives disproportionately shaped U.S. foreign policy. Going back as far as the Haitian Revolution, fear of a successful slave rebellion in the newly formed United States strongly motivated southern politicians. As Karp mentions, to that end, Presidents Madison and Monroe, quote, used overwhelming force to destroy black maroon settlements in southern Florida, end quote. Fear of slave rebellions also briefly united the interests of American slaveholders and Cuban elites who wanted independence from Spain, but in the late 19th century, after abolition, Roosevelt's forces fought in conjunction with Afro-Cuban armies against their common Spanish foe. The move to wrest Cuba and Puerto Rico from Spain came just as Spain had finally relented to end slavery as a concession to black rebel Cuban armies that had formed to push for independence. In a further move to placate continued unrest on the island, in November 1897, Spain signed automatic charters for Cuba and Puerto Rico, which gave limited home rule governments to both islands. Puerto Rico would gain full representation in the Cortes, the Spanish Parliament, and could veto Spanish commercial treaties unfavorable to them while also retaining the rights to set tariffs on imports and exports. In this way, Puerto Ricans were granted a kind of citizenship that allowed self-government grafted on what was left of their Spanish subjecthood. Yet on July 25th, 1898, 8 days after the first meeting of the newly formed Puerto Rican Parliament, U.S. troops arrived in the southern port of Guanica and replaced the Spanish flag with the Stars and Stripes. This date would be remembered over 50 years later when the United States finally followed through on a project to allow Puerto Ricans to have limited autonomy and self-government. But at the time, it was both the end of Teddy Roosevelt's splendid little war and the beginning of the current quandary over what exactly Puerto Rico's new colonial master would do with the island. Although historians agree that there was no pre-existing plan for designating Puerto Rico's status, there was a general belief that Puerto Rico could be incorporated as a U.S. territory and probably would be. This led many to assume that it would follow a similar path to statehood as former territories like Florida and Louisiana. At the very least, it would, by acceding to military control, receive, quote, the advantages and blessings of enlightened civilization, end quote, as Puerto Rico's first military governor, Nelson A. Miles, declared 3 days after the landing of Guanica. Because Cuba was so militarized during its wars for independence, the United States decided to allow it national sovereignty, thinking it could still exert considerable control over the economy because of existing business interests and a ready-made set of Cuban consumers who were already buying Ford Model Ts. But although Puerto Rico had experienced anti-Spanish uprisings in the mid-19th century, in 1898 they did not have nearly the same level of armed mobilization present. So the United States held on to it, particularly because of its geographic location, which would provide the United States with a stronghold on the easternmost tip of the Caribbean. The book is Fantasy Island by Ed Morales.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the second hour of our program. So my op-ed today over at HartmanReport.com is titled, Where the Hell Are the Democratic Warriors Ready to Take the Fight to Trump's Fascism and the GOP Machine? Yeah, where are they? Now, Monday morning, on this program, I was complaining about the fact that CNN and MSNBC had both spent 40 minutes carrying a live press conference by Donald Trump, in which he lied through his teeth, talked about privatizing the post office, mused about ending school children's vaccines for polio, threatened an Iowa newspaper pollster. I mean, you know, it's just a typical Trump BS fest. And I went into this rant about, you know, where is Joe Biden? Well, it turns out I was uninformed, apparently. Joe Biden, at that same time, was giving a speech at the inauguration of the Francis Perkins National Monument to FDR's Labor Secretary Francis Perkins up in Maine. And he truthfully pointed out that in his 1 4-year term, he created 16 million jobs, which is more than all the jobs created by Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and Trump combined. That's 16 years of Republicans created fewer jobs than Joe Biden did in 4 years. None of the media carried it. Trump's press conference, we're still talking about 3 days later. Biden's press conference, not a word. So I get it. There's a media bias against Democrats generally, or you could argue for Trump. I mean, we saw this with, you know, Les Moonves, the head of CBS News, saying, you know, it's making us money. Keep it up. Keep it up, Donald. But that doesn't mean that elected Democrats need to run and hide. I mean, Americans across the country are terrified, particularly in red states where women are bleeding out while the morbidly rich and the religious fanatics are licking their chops. So where the hell are the Democrats? What happened to when we fight, we win? I mean, even when the media would rather ignore you, even when the media is against you, political theater still works. Standing up to bullies still works. Fighting back becomes even more imperative. Where the hell, for example, is Kamala Harris? She told us Trump was a fascist. She said he was a threat to the country. She said he was going to destroy the... She said, quote, Donald Trump has said he would terminate the Constitution of the United States. That sounds like a five-alarm fire. So where has she been since the election? Did Trump's fascism just go away? His threat to terminate the Constitution was just a joke? Where the hell is she? For that matter, where the hell are the leaders in the Democratic Party? It seems like Nancy Pelosi's been spending her time trying to keep Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from getting leadership of the Oversight Committee, handing it off instead to a 74-year-old congressman with throat cancer. I mean, really? The headline over at KamalaHarris.com right now says, "Our fight continues," all capital letters. And below that it says, "Please donate to hold the Trump administration accountable." Really? How's she going to do that from wherever she and Tim Walz are hiding? Please tell me. Is it that Trump has succeeded in cowing the Democrats as fast as he has our largest corporations, their billionaire owners, and Joe and Mika? I mean, a few Democratic members of Congress have even said, "We look forward to working with Trump and his muskrat buddy." Is this some kind of sick joke? Remember the night of President Obama's first inauguration? At the same time, Louise and I were dancing with Barack and Michelle at Union Station. Republican leaders were gathered at the Caucus Room restaurant in Washington, D.C. to organize a massive resistance campaign against America's first black president. It was the entire leadership of the GOP. Eric Cantor, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Kevin McCarthy, Paul Ryan, Pete Sessions, Senators Tom Coburn, Bob Corker, Jim DeMint, John Ensign, John Kyle, Newt Gingrich, and Frank Luntz, who organized the meeting. I wrote an article about it back in the day for Truthout. This is what I wrote. Over juicy steaks and fancy cocktails in a private room in the back of the restaurant, the Republican bigwigs promised each other that they would filibuster and obstruct any and all legislation supported by President Obama. Congressman Pete Sessions, who was at the four-hour-long dinner, even promised to use Taliban-like tactics to achieve these goals. Kevin McCarthy said that he would obstruct every single piece of legislation, including things Republicans used to support. The caucus room conspiracy had three major objectives. Number one, use obstruction, knowing that the corporate media would call it gridlock and blame both parties to prevent Obama from having any legislative success. Number two, sabotage any legislative victories that the president did have, you know, like Obamacare, and convince U.S. citizens they were actually failures. And number three, to blame all the economic damage caused by this Republican sabotage on both parties and then come out and say, "We're going to fix it if you just elect us." Kevin McCarthy came out of the meeting and told a reporter, he said, "If you act like you're in the minority, you're going to stay in the minority. We've got to challenge them on every single bill and challenge them on every single campaign." And sure enough, they did. They continue to do so to this day. And the voters, by the way, rewarded them by shellacking President Obama and his Democrats in the 2014 election. Remember? Excuse me, in the 2010 election. Where are the Democrats today with that kind of spine? Where is our resolve to fight rather than enable fascists? What happened to our principles, our commitment to democracy? 24-year-old Parkland survivor and gun activist David Hogg, one of the Democratic Party's up-and-coming stars, I would say, pointed out that the Democratic Party has become far too reliant on self-interested consultants. He said, quote, "Throughout the campaign, there were multiple times that I brought up publicly my concern about young voters, and I was shut down by consultants and messaged by them saying, 'You don't know what you're talking about. This is not an issue. This is dumb of you to say,' and a whole lot of other things I can't tell you on TV." He said, "We need to build a party that tells people what it needs to hear, not what its consultants are paid to say." There were a few brave governors who stepped up and spoke out. You know, J.B. Pritzker, Gavin Newsom, Lujan Grisham, and a few others who said, "No, we're going to fight Trump's mass deportations." And then the party went silent. Now, this isn't how Democrats used to do this. LBJ ate the Republicans' lunch. He destroyed them legislatively. Franklin Roosevelt, he called them and the people who backed them economic royalists. He said, "These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain about is that we seek to take away their power. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power." Philadelphia, 1936. Republicans called FDR a tyrant and a communist, and he laughed at them. They said he'd destroy America. He steamrolled them. They whined and complained as he called out their fat cats and ridiculed that generation's Republican Party. He rendered them impotent. When one wealthy man famously said he'd have to leave the country because of FDR's 90% income tax, FDR said, well, I will miss him very much. To laughter. You've all heard the clip on this program. He named names. He was arrogant. He fought hard on behalf of the average person until literally the day he died. Where is this generation's FDR? Where are the Democratic Party's heroes? Where are our spokespeople? Where is their outrage? Or do Democrats expect Trump to just magically morph into Mitt Romney on January 20th? Five-alarm fire is over? Fire is out? Disaster averted? What the hell? Kamala Harris lost the election. She lost by a whisker, but she lost. But if she and other leaders and would-be leaders of the Democratic Party don't stand up now to challenge Trump and this fascist crew that he's assembling, don't offer a contrasting vision for the future of our country today, if they don't challenge Trump's outrageous policies and bizarre appointees every single day, they're going to lose our democracy as well. Democrats. It's time to grow a damn spine. 15 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back with you. Trump is already he's already walking back his promises. Why don't the newspapers have headlines that simply say, oh, Trump lied about this? I'll share that with you on the other side of the break, and I'll pick up your calls. Stay with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. I'll be right back with you. And welcome back. Bobby in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for letting me call in. I wanted to piggyback. I was originally called in when Mark Pocan was on the line, and you already touched on it. Where are the Democratic leaders coming out against fascism? And I think you have to look right to the point of this recent oversight chairmanship position. We have a Democratic Party establishment that is literally getting in the way of progressive leaders championing progressive ideals and taking on the Trump administration and the fascism they represent. So I think we have to look right at this older generation of establishment Democrats. They are responsible for this election loss, not having a real strong approach in combating fascism. And I don't know why people like Mark Pocan, I wish I had been able to ask him, why are they so timid? Why is the progressive caucus so timid in naming out people like Nancy Pelosi who are getting in the way of progressive champions carrying this party forward? I think they need to take the gloves off. AOC has played nice in the sandbox. She's proven herself, and it's gotten her nowhere. So now it's time to take the gloves off.
Well, it's actually gotten her some pretty good successes, but I agree with your point, Bobby, and I think Nancy Pelosi has some splaining to do. And, as I shared with, Congressman Pocan, we have, Richie Neal is 75 years old. He's running Ways and Means. Ways and Means is the tax writing committee. Richie Neal and oversees the insurance industry. Neal just got $412,000 from the insurance industry just this year. I mean, and even more, six-figure donations, some HMOs and pharmaceutical companies. Frank Pallone, 73. He's the head of energy and commerce. He's gotten over $1 million from electric utilities. I mean, this is just wrong. This is just friggin' wrong. Bobby, thank you. Susan in Caldwell, Idaho. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, you can answer my question. It was actually for Mr. Pocan. You know, this Social Security Fairness Act that might get a vote in the Senate but passed overwhelmingly in the House, that would pay government retirees who took the government jobs that did, in many cases, did not withdraw Social Security taxes by design because they had their own pension situations. Right. To pay them money now when they did. I've seen both sides of this argument. Overwhelmingly comments from the union members. Nothing bad about union, but I see where their self-interest is here, you know, to get this money back. And they all say, well, this all started with Reagan. I remember way before Reagan looking at Social Security as a kid, and it was very clear. If you go into a public pension-type job, like a teaching for was the big one, they will not take Social Security taxes out of your paycheck. Therefore, you will not get that Social Security benefit. Fair's fair. You got a government-guaranteed pension. So I don't get this thing with the Fairness Act that's supposedly going to blow another hole in the Social Security finances with no plan
to fix that. It's not going to be that big a hole. It's not going to be that big a hole. They're just compared to the whole size of Social Security. And a lot of these people, you know, their pensions just aren't what they used to be. I get it. You know, like you said, Susan, I can argue both sides of that one. I think the bigger issue is let's get rid of the damn cap on Social Security. And that legislation does not do that, sadly. And that's really what we need to be doing. Susan, thank you for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Change starts with you. You can be calling your Democratic or Republican representatives to let them know what you think by calling 202-224-3121. It's the Capitol switchboard. It'll get you right through to them. From Los Angeles to Columbia, South Carolina, from Birmingham, Alabama to Baltimore, universal basic income programs are chalking up proof after proof of their viability. Basically, just giving people, low-income people, poor people, somewhere between $500 and $1,500 a month, no strings attached, is lifting people out of poverty, getting them back on track, getting them into solid middle-class jobs, helping their children tremendously. This works. Now, we don't have to do UBI in the United States. We're the only developed country in the world that doesn't have a national health care program. Health expenses are whacking a lot of low-income people. We're the only country, developed country in the world that doesn't have free college education. Education expenses are whacking people. There's a lot we could do. We can subsidize housing. We can subsidize food. We do that with food stamps. We could expand it. There's a lot we could do to benefit from this. There's a whole report about that over at HartmanReport.com. Check it out.
Trump's on the screen with his circus lies. 40 minutes of fear, 40 minutes televised. He's ranting, he's raving like it's all for show. While Biden's out there, but nobody knows. 60 million jobs in 4 short years. Built with truth, not chaos or fear. But the cameras don't care, they're chasing the flame. Where are the Democrats to win this game? Where are the Democrats? Why don't they fight? Trump's screaming fascism in broad daylight. The fire's still burning, but no one's there. Where are the leaders who used to care? Where's the FDRs, the LBJs, calling out the green, showing us the way? If democracy's dying, we can't sit back. So where are the Democrats? Kamala said it's a 5-alarm fire. Trump wants the Constitution thrown in the pyre. But where's her voice? Where's the rallying cry? You don't win a war just standing by. Republicans plot like they did back then. A caucus room deal, sabotage again. They're building their empire brick by brick. And silence from the left just makes me sick. Where are the Democrats?
Welcome back. 23 minutes past the hour. So Donald Trump is now walking back his campaign promises. Of course. Congressman Pocan said, you know, Trump basically, you know, 95% of what he said he was going to do, he didn't do. That's kind of a rhetorical phrase. The actual number, there's PolitiFact actually broke down the numbers. And he kept 23% of his promises, and he fully broke 53% of them in his last term as president. And now he's, remember he was going to scrap Obamacare? Remember he was going to have an infrastructure bill? Remember he was going to have a balanced budget? He had none of those things, of course not. And what's so funny is he ran on a slogan of promises made, promises kept. Remember that? Big signs at the RNC when the Republican promises made. Lies said, lies continuing, basically. So anyhow, in 2024, this year, he said he was going to end the Ukraine-Russia war in 24 hours after he was elected. Well, it's been what? 3 weeks? 4 weeks? I don't know. I don't have a calendar, but 5 weeks. And the war is still going on. He says he was going to deport 11 million immigrants. I'm skeptical. We'll see. He said that his tariffs won't raise costs for consumers. Right now, this was NPR did a whole story on this morning. Right now, companies that import things from China, Japan, Taiwan, you know, you name it, mostly from Asia, but companies that import goods are doubling up on those goods right now and raising their prices, which is causing the Fed to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't cut interest rates any further because they're expecting Trump's tariffs. So when he was asked about that on television, he was said, you know, you said that your tariffs won't raise costs for anybody. And he said, yeah, can you guarantee that? And he said, I can't guarantee anything. Right. Then he said, when he was running for president, he said, I'm going to lower grocery prices. He said this over and over and over again. I mean, you know, he on Truth Social, prices are too high. The consumer's angry at this incompetent administration. Kamala has no idea to bring prices down. She's afraid to even discuss it with the fake news media, even worse than her VP candidate. She doesn't even have a clue. I will do it. It will happen fast. So Time Magazine's Eric Cordalesa asks Trump, you said you were going to lower grocery prices. Are you going to? Trump's response, and I quote, it's hard to bring things down once they're up. You know, it's very hard. Oh, poor Donald. He desperately tried to distance himself from Project 2025. Remember that? He says, you read some of the things in Project 2025. They're extreme. They're seriously extreme. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to know anything about it. Right. And now the head of, you know, the main architect of Project 2025, Russell Volk, is going to run his office management and budget. Paul Atkins, who was an author of Project 2025, he's going to run the Securities and Exchange Commission. Brendan Carr, who was an author of Project 2025, he's going to run the Federal Communications Commission. Tom Homan, who's going to be his border czar, helped write Project 2025. John Ratcliffe, who helped write Project 2020, he's going to head up the CIA, and the list goes on. Why won't the headlines simply say Trump lied? Hey, Republicans, you are suckered. Why can't our media simply tell the truth? Republican voters were suckered in 2016. More than half of the time, Trump outright broke his promises. He didn't even keep a quarter of them. And this time, he's already breaking his promises. Republicans, are you feeling like suckers yet?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Give me a shout, Trump voters. I'd love to hear from you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'll pick up your calls after this. And welcome back to our Tom Hartman University Book Club. Today we're reading from Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green, the subtitle Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. This is from the afterword, the very last chapter. It's titled Kali Yuga, which in Hinduism is when the earth goes into a phase of destruction. In the shell-shocked aftermath of the election, President Obama, looking shaken, appeared in the White House Rose Garden to deliver public remarks intended to project a sense of calm. A sense, really, that the basic stability of our country remained intact. Sun is up, Obama said. I know everybody had a long night. I did as well. Had a chance to talk to President-elect Trump last night about 3:30 in the morning, I think it was, to congratulate him on winning the election. End of quote. The next day, when the two men appeared together in the Oval Office, it felt as if the world had slipped through the looking glass. Trump quickly named Bannon his chief White House strategist. Republicans controlled every branch of government. With Trump's ability to defy every political norm, anything seemed possible. Who could argue otherwise after what had just transpired? And yet, within days of his inauguration, Trump's White House was plunged into chaos and scandal from which it has not recovered and may never.
Bannon, the imaginative reconceiver of U.S. politics, hung streams of paper listing Trump's promises from the walls of his West Wing office. His strategy, as always, was to launch furious attacks, this time to, quote, shock the system, end quote, and rapidly reorient the federal government in a more nationalist direction. He called this, with what I took to be intentional irony, a shock-and-awe approach to asserting Trump's power. But Trump's flurry of activity quickly ran into problems. There was his executive order, sprung a week after his inauguration, banning immigrants from seven majority Muslim countries, which set off nationwide protests and was blocked by the courts. His firing 2 weeks later of National Security Director Michael Flynn for contacts with the Russians. The collapse of his first major legislative initiative, a bill to repeal Obamacare. His firing of FBI Director James Comey. And the swift descent of the West Wing into a viper's nest of backstabbing and leaks. This quick turn toward a crack-up was hardly unforeseeable or even altogether surprising, but it contrasted sharply with the success of a candidate who had dominated his opponents, shaped news coverage, and shown himself to be all but impervious to the forces that overwhelm other politicians. Bannon, whose wild gambits in the campaign had invariably paid off, seemed to run out of magic tricks when Hillary Clinton was no longer a target. The government wasn't as malleable to Trump and Bannon's aggressions as the Republican Party and the cable news channels had been, and they found themselves consistently thwarted and undermined by the courts, by right-wing hardliners in Congress, by their own inexperience and Trump's errant tweets, and by the bureaucracy they were now overseeing. The crises these failures precipitated in the White House cost Bannon much of his influence and soon threatened Trump's presidency. While it's still early in his term, the possibilities that Trump's most ardent supporters once imagined for his presidency already seem to be mostly foreclosed. I think there are three main reasons why Trump's administration has so quickly fallen into disorder and confusion. Number one, Trump thought being president was about asserting dominance. Just after he'd locked up the GOP nominations, Trump said something to me that crystallized his view of politics and explains, to my mind, much of his subsequent difficulties. Quote, I deal with people that are very extraordinarily talented people, he told me. I deal with Steve Wynn. I deal with Carl Icahn. I deal with killers that blow these politicians away. It's not even the same category. This, he meant politics, this is a category that's like 19 levels lower. You understand what I'm saying? Brilliant killers. Trump was equating politics with business and the presidency with the job of being a big-shot CEO, a killer. He filled the upper ranks of his administration with people of a similar mindset. Gary Cohn, Wilbur Ross, Steve Bannon, aggressive, domineering men, accustomed to getting their way by dint of their position. None had government experience, nor did many others in the West Wing. So none anticipated the problems this approach to governing would cause. Trump's self-conception as the all-powerful apprentice boss blinded him to a fundamental truth of the modern presidency, that the president needs Congress more than the Congress needs the president. Trump's domineering instincts serve him poorly, since most members of Congress are secure in their jobs and accountable mainly to their own constituents. And it backfired disastrously when Trump fired Comey after he refused to submit to a pledge of loyalty to his boss. Number two, Trump ran against the Republican Party, Wall Street, and Paul Ryan, but then took up their agenda. Populists often struggle to govern, but Trump scarcely attempted to lead the populist revolution that he promised. In May, he told me he would transform the Republican Party into a workers' party. But while he kept voicing populist shibboleths, the legislative agenda he took up was the standard conservative fare pushed by Paul Ryan. During the GOP primary, Trump has shrewdly sensed its weak point, Ryan's desire to finance tax cuts for the rich by cutting programs like Social Security and Medicaid, armed the party's white blue-collar base. Trump told me he'd made this point to Ryan directly. He said, quote, there's no way a Republican is going to beat a Democrat when the Republican is saying we're going to cut your Social Security and the Democrat is saying we're going to keep it and give you more. The book is Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and Stormy the President.
Share the Tom Hartman program with your friends. Our podcast, The Hartman Report, is absolutely free and available wherever fine podcasts are available. And the entire three-hour podcast is available over at TomHartman.com.
You're a mean one, Mr. Trump. You govern with disdain. You stacked the court with chaos and left us all in pain, Mr. Trump.
Welcome back. 34 You've minutes past the hour. Picking up your calls here. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, the rant at the top of the hour was fantastic, and I really do wish the Democrats would get up off their rear ends and do something.
Amen.
But the reason I called... The post office is the only federal agency in the Constitution. To get rid of the post office is going to require a constitutional amendment unless Trump just decides to throw the entire Constitution in the trash.
I don't think that's true, Norma.
It's in the Constitution. Are you just going to go ahead and sell a federal agency without even looking at the Constitution?
The reference to it is in Article 1, Section, 7 or 8, you know, where it lists all the things that Congress can appropriate money for, and one of them is postal roads. Congress can appropriate money for roads, where they've done that. But the post office
and the whole
is not...
The whole point was to ensure rural delivery of mail to provide communication.
I get it. But we all know that if they privatize the post office, what's going to happen is that, low income areas, particularly inner city areas and rural areas where it is not as easy to serve, those people are going to, and it's not as profitable to serve them, service them, are going to lose out to high rise apartment buildings and suburbs. That are easy to serve, and you know it's all going to be run for profit. I get that it's a terrible thing, but I don't think the constitutional argument is going to save it. I think it's going to be Democrats standing up and saying, "Hell no."
Yeah. Well, has anybody even brought up the fact that you would have to have an account with one of these companies to get your mail delivered? And what about the people who use post office for money orders? And where will we get our passports from? The post office serves the United States, and it has been decimated by this guy that's running it, who's a Trump supporter.
Agreed.
And this should be a scandal on TV, and
Agreed.
It's not. Instead, they're saying, oh, we're going to fix it by selling it and privatizing it.
Yep.
Well, instead, they should fix it by making it efficient and keep it a federal agency.
You know, it used to be a federal agency. It is no longer. The post office is no longer a federal agency. It is now a private corporation. It's one of a very small handful of corporations that were chartered at the federal level. Most corporations are typically chartered in the states. 99.99999% of all corporations are chartered in states. But
that should never have happened.
I agree. Amtrak. Yeah. And the Postal Service. And this happened, I believe, during the Reagan administration. I remember when it happened, and my recollection is it was Reagan. It might have been Bush Sr. But the whole pitch was, we're going to make it more efficient, just like we're going to do with Amtrak, by spinning it off as a private public partnership. It's going to be a separate corporation. Congress will continue to fund it. But, actually, in the new law that passed says that Congress can no longer fund the post office. It has to be self-sustaining. It has to be self-funding. And that's why they have to raise postal rates, But that was the beginning of the process. That was the camel's nose under the tent. And all the Republicans at the time were like, oh, no, we're not trying to privatize the post office. We're just trying to improve it. But this was the setup for privatization. Because right now, Norma, they can privatize it without having to violate the Constitution. They can do it with a simple piece of legislation.
Well, I also have been sitting here, Tom, wondering what is wrong with the Democrats if they have not passed a law that a person convicted of felon should not be able to be elected to any kind of public office.
Right.
Why haven't we passed a law that a felon should not be able to be elected to a public office?
Yeah, Trump can't own a gun. Yeah. He can't vote in Florida. So why?
Tell me something. If he does on the first day, stand up and declare himself a dictator, what will the Democrats do? Will anybody even protest?
Well, if we're looking at today's Democrats right now, the way the party is responding, I think they'll probably all say, well, let's go have a retreat in Costa Rica and then just stay there for 2 years. I don't know. Norma, thank you. I share your outrage. Thank you. Nikki in Chicago. Hey, Nikki, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I, too, am outraged by the post office, and I just don't understand why we can't improve on what's going on and get rid of the joy, and I don't understand all of that. But anyway, going forward, when we talk about what happened with the CEO and everyone complains, I understand that. It is definitely
you're talking the United
not
Healthcare
acceptable
CEO?
To kill someone.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Yeah. Okay, but that was an extreme movement. We have to remember what John Lewis said about good trouble, because that's what it's going to take to fight the Republicans going forward. We're not going to be able to just sit here and depend on the judicial system and everything else to do what it should do. We as Democrats are going to have to physically do something, whether it be sitting at the lunch counter or sitting on the bus. It's something like that. Maybe the obstetricians all need to go on strike in order to fix Roe v. Wade. I mean, just something's going to have to be dramatic to change this course.
I absolutely agree. And in fact, I thank you for that good trouble. I just edited that into my into my article for today because that
I couldn't think of it.
That's a great question. That's, you know, yeah. The Democrats need to grow a spine. I mean, it's just that I've been saying that for a lot of years. I used to say that I used to make jokes about Harry Reid. I used to make jokes about how Harry Reid needed to go stand outside Arnold Schwarzenegger's governor's mansion and snatch his testosterone when it came, which I realize is kind of a semi-sexist joke. But, you know, it reflected my thinking at the time, which was that Harry Reid needed to grow a spine. And, testosterone aside, I still feel that way. And this latest thing of Nancy Pelosi just sabotaging AOC is just it just has me just horrified. So but, you know, go ahead.
I am so proud of AOC.
Me too.
I don't believe that you can have an entire Democratic Party of AOC or Bernie Sanders. I think there has to be pieces that come up with these little pearls, and they get sent into the mainstream, and the mainstream needs to massage those pearls to make them bipartisan or somehow palatable for the other side, and that's how we accomplish things.
Yeah,
I think those thinkers are the ones who are really going to make the changes.
Yeah,
maybe not having a whole party of them, but you certainly need that, and even the MAGA. There should always be a couple of MAGAs out there in their Republican Party. That's fine. The problem is we've got an entire party of MAGAs.
Yeah. No, I agree. And, I used to essentially ridicule the great man theory of history. I forget who came up with the theory, but, there was this idea that history is written by leaders who step forward. And I used to think, no, it's, you know, the leaders come about because the times demand it. You know, like FDR, had it not been for the Great Depression, FDR would not have been able to do what he did. But increasingly, it is becoming obvious to me that there actually are some people who are just incredibly talented politically. And AOC is one of those people, and they do change history. For the better or for the worse. Hitler was one of those people, too. And Donald Trump is one of those people. It's sad to admit, but it's true. And where are the stars in the Democratic Party? I think we know where they are. And we also see that the gerontocracy, the 80, 70 and 80 year olds in the party are doing their best to keep a lid on those young people. You know, I want to see Maxwell Frost. I want to see more of Jasmine Crockett. I want to see I want to see David Hogg, get into Congress. I'm ranting here now. Nikki, thank you for the call. I agree. Thank you. You said it so well. Jerry in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Paul. I'm sorry, Tom. I was hoping to talk to the congressman, but I can ask you the question too. Of course. We found out in this election that but Florida is definitely a red state. No question about it.
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, if you push a couple million people off the voting rolls and you intimidate black voters by throwing a bunch of them in prison, then, yeah, you got a red state. But I don't think the majority of Florida voters love Ron DeSantis, frankly. I could be wrong, but but you live there. I don't. So, Jerry, I'll respect your opinion, and I'm not going to argue with you.
Well, there's going to be two groups that now voted against their own self-interest. The seniors, not this senior, but many of the seniors voted against their own self-interest. But what I have heard really turned Florida for Trump was South Florida. I heard that there was a 118,000 vote difference between him and Kamala Harris, and a lot of it came from the Hispanics down there who thought that this deportation thing was going to be the other Hispanics, not them.
That's right. These are the Cuban Americans who are like, yeah, get rid of the Mexican Americans. We don't like them. I totally understand.
Now, here's my question. Have you found out, or in your conversations with Congressman Pocan or other members of Congress, exactly how this is going to work? How I understand that that South Florida is going to be ground zero for the beginning of this. How are they going to tell the, quote, bad ones from the good ones?
Right. What I'm hearing, Jerry, and, you know, this is kind of leaking out around the edges, but what we're hearing is that, number one, the Trump people are quietly talking to some of the right-wing militia folks to get some independent help, shall we say. Number two, they're talking to sheriffs, particularly members of Sheriff Mac's organization or organizations like that, these so-called constitutional sheriffs, these right-wing, hardcore right-wing sheriffs who think that they're like the senior, you know, officers in their states or counties. And of course, he's talking about employing the National Guard in each one of the states. And I obviously, he's going to start with the red states. I think you're right. Probably Florida, Texas are going to be the first two. And that they will be his testing ground. And if he has success there, he's going to try and roll it out nationally. But really, right now, nobody knows. Jerry, thank you for the call. 46 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It was Thomas Carlyle who came up with the great man theory of history. We'll be right back. And just FYI, Sean tells me that the post office was spun off as a separate federally chartered corporation during the Nixon administration. Amazing. I didn't realize it was that far back, but I do vividly remember the debate. I really do. Anyhow, what's on your mind? Lamar in Pasadena, California. Hey, Lamar, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Great. I was trying to catch up. Mr. Pocan, but I guess I'm a little too late.
You're
for
stuck
that.
With me, Lamar. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's not a big drop off there, I don't think. But anyway, since my topic was going to be about Jack Smith being appointed by Biden, I talked to you about that a couple of weeks ago. But let me go to Pelosi and AOC. Mm. Since they have this gerontology thing going with the Democratic Party, maybe AOC, Maxwell Frost, David Hogg, and some of the squad can kind of put together their own coalition, try not to ruffle too many feathers, but, you know, try to keep the Democratic Party together, but still advance an agenda that's going to, you know, retard this fascism revolution or whatever it is that's going on. You have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's the big challenge, Lamar, and this has to be weighing heavily on AOC and people associated with her. The big challenge is the fact that five Republicans on the U.S. Supreme Court legalized political bribery. They said, you know, it's just fine if you want to bribe a politician. It's now called free speech instead of bribery. And the consequence of that is that, you know, for example, we had two members of the squad who were taken down, by AIPAC, by the American Israel Political Action Committee.
Yeah.
which is obscene. We had a member of a wannabe member of Congress here, Sheila Jayapal, Pramila Jayapal's sister, who works in government here in Oregon. She was running for the U.S. House of Representatives, and she had said that, you know, we need to stop weapons sales to Israel. And so the AIPAC came in here with millions of dollars and just carpet bombed the area. So as long as political bribery continues to be legal in the United States, and by the way, we're the only advanced democracy in the world where this is legal. As long as that continues to be the case, we're going to have a really serious problem. And all of these politicians who want to actually create change, all of the genuinely progressive politicians, you know, the AOCs and the Cory Bushes and the Maxwell Frosts and you name it, they're all, you know, hanging by a thread that can be cut or lit on fire by people like AIPAC or by, you know, Elon Musk coming in like he's doing right now to Joni Ernst. He's running ads in Iowa because Joni Ernst wasn't sufficiently enthusiastic for Pete Hegseth. And so he's running ads in Iowa that are suggesting that maybe she should have a primary challenger because she's up for re-election in 2 years. And suddenly she's going, oh, wait, you know, I didn't mean that. Please let me kiss your butt, Mr. Trump, Mr. Hegseth, please come by. Yes. Nothing wrong with sexual assault in the military, you know, et cetera. I mean, this is the cancer at the heart of our democracy, is that you had five well-bribed Republicans on the U.S. Supreme Court who said, hey, bribing judges like us, not illegal. That's called free speech. Bribing politicians, of course, have to fall in the same category, so politicians can get bribed too. And Clarence Thomas walks away with millions of dollars in gifts, his mother's new house, his son's new college, or his new education. And the billionaires are just licking their chops. Lamar, thank you for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Hey, thanks so much for sharing our program and for reaching out to our stations and sponsors and letting them know that you're listening. It really means a lot to us.
Up at the North Pole, there's a man with a list. Check unit twice, seeing who he'll assist. Santa's been listening, the word's getting clear. He tunes to Tom Hartman this time every year. Does Santa Claus listen to the Tom Hartman show?
He's one learning about democracy. Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Patrick in Seattle. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, good morning. First of all, happy holidays. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you, back at you, Patrick.
Thanks. I'm 70 years old, Tom, and I'm probably going to keep voting for Democrats for the rest of my life. But why would one young person or one independent voter do the same thing? You know, you've been great. You've been talking about the Democrats' disappearance. But, you know, also there's this rigged insider quality of everything they do that just is making me crazy. And at some level, to an uninformed voter, this must look just like the Republicans.
Yep.
You know, Chuck Schumer's in the Senate Democrats. You know, he's got one job, really, and that's to deliver Democratic votes. And he's been thwarted from day one until last week by Manchin and Sinema. Chuck Schumer's a failure.
Yep.
You know, and everybody's talking about Democratic messaging failure, but elderly Nancy Pelosi has just thwarted the most effective messenger the Democrats have in favor of Jerry Connolly. And there's like a dark metaphor there, you know, scuttling this brilliant young speaker for an old man with throat cancer. I took your advice, Tom Hartman, and the day after the election, I tried to reach out to my local Democratic Party. There's no way to contact them in person. Just an invitation to a freaking Zoom call in January. That's it. What do we do?
It's a place to start, Patrick. It's a place to start. And if you can get on the inside, and you can get a few friends on the inside, you can change things. I mean, that's the work we've got. I don't see an alternative. I really don't. We're not going to be able to start a third party. The Democratic Party is a $1 billion corporation. That's the bad news, I guess, or that's the good news, too, because the door is wide open in most cases. I realize there are some places where the Democratic Party is so heavily run like an old boys club that it's really hard to break in. It's really hard to get anything done. I hear those stories from people who call from around the country, you know, particularly in some rural areas, for example. But generally speaking, if enough good people get inside the party, they can change it. And that's another op-ed that I need to write is, you know, become a precinct committee person. It's important. Patrick, thank you. I share your concerns. Claudia in Newport, Oregon. Hey, Claudia, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I share his concerns, too. And it almost seems like the Democratic Party has been infiltrated for many years.
Well, I think when the Supreme Court changed the rules of the game, Democrats really had to play by those new rules or they wouldn't have had any power at all.
Right. Right. The money game. I get it. Yes. You're right. But and thank you for the conversation today. It's a very good show. I'm talking about today Trump's magic diversions, you know, is kind of what Pocan calls his bluster, okay? Mm-hmm. His diversions. And I'm thinking what maybe people aren't thinking about. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
I'm thinking that maybe everything that's obvious, right, that everybody wants, Social Security, you know, the polio vaccine, everybody wants that stuff. It's so obvious. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that's a diversion and that Trump is, okay, he's going to let the Congress, his idiot Congress, I mean, pass certain things, then at the end he'll be our savior. He'll save us from everything and veto it and say, I care about you, lovely citizens.
Yeah. We'll see. I fully expect that we're going to see a repeat of what we saw during his last administration, which is every day he's going to go out and he's going to lie to the cameras, and a large percentage of Americans are going to believe his lies. And the media is not going to challenge
them. I don't think it's going to be the same. I think that people like Bannon and a lot of, I mean, Putin, give me a break, you know. Russian psyops, it's very, I don't have a word for it, but it's
effective
there.
Is what it is. It's effective. Claudia, right. Thank you very much. Aaron in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Hey, Aaron, what's on your mind? We have just a minute, by the way.
A lot now. I'll try to maintain my focus. I'll start my comments at the end. On the 4th of July, 2026, it won't be a celebration of the 250th birthday of America. It will be a requiem of America. Now, I'm with you. Now, I'll go back to when you were talking about Mitch McConnell and, you know, everything he said about Barack Obama. And when he told Barack Obama to his face that you will never see Supreme Court justice, and then we'll do everything to impede you. That was sedition. That's in the Constitution. That should have been the end of that.
Yeah, but I don't think that was sedition. I think that was politics, Aaron.
No, it was sedition because sedition is it's an organization that acknowledges the overthrow or the impediment of a duly elected government. You can.
I understand your argument. I absolutely understand your argument. And morally, I 100% agree with you. Legally, though, it's just politics. And Democrats need to learn how to play hardball politics, too. Aaron, thank you for the call. We'll be back on the other side of this break with Heidi Kuta. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Tune in for some fresh raps and classic cuts right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and beyond on some breakbeats and rhymes.
Breakbeats and rhymes. Big thanks, baby, yo.
Breakbeats and rhymes.
Hey, yo, yo, y'all can't stand right here. In his right hand was your man's worst nightmare. Loud enough to burst his right eardrum close range. The game is not only dangerous, but it's most strange.
Heard every Friday night from 10 to midnight.
Breakbeats and rhymes hosted by Rebels to the